So it's worth sort of being conscious about how we approach Buddhism here at the Buddhist Centre. So, most, for those of you who come to the Wednesday class, you know that we approach it by teaching meditation. So for most of you, I would imagine, some of you perhaps not, but most of you will have learned to meditate. Out of that meditation, we'll start to feel, oh yes, I'd like to explore the context of meditation, the Buddhist context of meditation. Perhaps that's brought you to this course. Yeah? So most of us nowadays, at least in this movement, come to Buddhism through meditation primarily. And quite a lot of people seem to come to meditation through something like yoga, through a concern about stress and so on. You know, that you come to meditation through that. And perhaps some people increasingly are coming to meditation through our MBCT work or health work. Yeah? The traditional approach to Buddhism was through ethics. So the great sort of traditional description of the Buddhist path, and Buddhism is primarily a path, the path is probably the central metaphor of Buddhism. You have the metaphor of the path and the metaphor of the opening lotus, and both those metaphors can correct each other. So if you want to know what Buddhism is, it's primarily a path, or if you don't like that, an opening lotus. Yeah? And actually you probably need a bit of both. The path suggests an onward movement, an onward change, but of course the problem with the path, as a metaphor, looks like you don't change, you just move through a scenery which changes. So the metaphor of the opening lotus is saying, oh no, you change. Yeah? The problem of the opening lotus is it's a static image and doesn't communicate the dynamic aspect of Buddhism quite so well. So what you often get in Buddhist history is one metaphor coming after another to deal with the shortcomings of the first metaphor. I might say more about metaphor later on. But from traditional point of view, the Buddhist path starts with ethics. And actually, even though we start with meditation here, actually most of us are starting with ethics. So when we say meditation, when Buddhism says meditation, it means samadhi, which is completely absorbed in meditation. So probably we don't start with that. We might have had what's called beginner's mind, perhaps. But most of us don't sit down and we're suddenly completely absorbed in meditation. What we normally find is we're distracted, that our mind's gone somewhere else. And actually, when we work with those distractions, when we work with our mind going somewhere, we're actually working with ethics. Because where our mind is going is usually an ethical issue. Usually it's because we're anxious, or because we feel ill will or aversion, or we want something, or we doubt something, or we're restless, or we feel sleepy. Usually what we call meditation is really trying to work with those things, what's called the five hindrances. And they're the ethical nature of the path. You're trying to not be wanting something that isn't in your experience right now. You're trying not to want to push things away in your experience. You're trying not to be anxious and all sort of cut up like that. You're trying not to be sleepy and slothful. You're trying to have confidence in the practice. So most of the time when we're meditating, what we're really doing, we don't quite teach like this, but what we're really doing is working on our ethics. And quite often when people meditate, they realise that their ethics are the issue. So ethics is really where the Buddhist practice starts. You start to notice, when you sit down to meditate, oh look, here I am in a bad temper, here I am anxious, here I am unable to just to watch my breath, here I am unable to cultivate metta, because I've just got a to-do list in my mind all the time. So all those are ethical issues, really. And what Buddhism would say is, well, we need to be working on ethics. Yeah? According to traditional Buddhism, you work on ethics, you then, in the meditation or outside of the meditation, you then enter what we call meditation, which is usually called samadhi, which is a state of purified concentration, where you're completely absorbed in the breath, or radiantly aware of loving-kindness. And that's all you are. You're not off somewhere else. You're just fully absorbed in your experience. you're saturated in your experience. And the closer you get to that, the more deeply pleasurable, the more deeply satisfying it is. You just feel, at last, I'm just in my experience, I'm not somewhere else, I'm not sort of all cut up, I'm just fully absorbed in experience. And all your energies come together, blockages in your mind come together, you have this great release of energy, it's usually extremely pleasurable, you feel a great sense of opening and of space. And then on the basis of meditation proper, as you could call it, or samadhi, you then start to turn your mind to wisdom. So that's the traditional Buddhist vision of what spiritual life is. Firstly, you're working on your mental state so that you're not disliking things, craving things, doubting about things, anxious about things. Once you've worked with that, you enter this wonderful state of samadhi, which feels everything you've ever wanted. It feels that at last life is of this beautiful harmonious whole. My experience of it is a bit like, you know, when you're in a room and the washing machine's on and you haven't really noticed it in the corner and suddenly it goes off and you're, oh, there's this lovely sense of, oh no, you know. You'd not notice just how kind of that was doing in your mind. Well, samadhi is a bit like that. It's like we've got this washing machine in our mind all the time with knickers going round, whatever it is. Very often knickers. And you hadn't noticed what disturbance it's causing to the psyche. And then when it goes off, it's just gloriously open. It's like letting go of something and suddenly you're in this new space. Yeah? So that's called samadhi, or let's call it samadhi. There's different levels of samadhi. In that wonderfully lucid, calm state of mind, you can usefully turn your mind towards the nature of reality. And I stress usefully, because the Buddhist tradition says, frankly, it's hardly worth doing it until you've got that state, you can get that state of mind. Yeah? Because your state of mind will prejudice your reflections. If you're in a negative state of mind, it'll prejudice your reflections about reality. You need to be in this particular kind of mind. I'll come back to that later. So you could then say, well, where does Buddhism start? It starts with our mind. It starts now, doesn't it? It starts with what we are just now. That's where Buddhism starts. It starts with you, in your mind. Never mind anybody else's mind just now. Your mind, and your experience with your mind. So that's one way you could say that Buddhism starts. But you could also say that Buddhism starts with shunyata. That Buddhism starts with it, with X, with shunyata, with emptiness, with the whole nature of reality. Yeah. So what we're trying to do on this course is try saying, okay, it starts with not our mind, but it starts with the nature of reality. It starts with shunyata. So if you think of it like this, you turn the path the other way around. So you say that what we're doing is looking at wisdom, then ethics. So wisdom, then meditation, then ethics. And that's what we're going to be doing on this course, is looking at the Buddhist path from the point of view, as it were, of the Buddha, rather than the point of view of my mind and my issues. We will, of course, be looking at that, because that's the primary thing. But you see how Buddhism is not just about your mind and what you need to do just now. It's saying that there is something else. Right from the start, it's saying there's much, much, much more to your experience than you think. There is something unimaginably more now, here and now, always, there is always, is imagined, unimaginably more. And that the Buddhist tradition, part of the Buddhist tradition, a great part of the Buddhist tradition, is trying to find words to express that inexpressibly, unimaginably more. Yeah? And the figure of Vajrasattva is in a figure trying to express that unexpressible, unimaginable more that's always present in life. Yeah? That's beyond anything to do with your mind, but also isn't separate from you, as if it was some kind of other reality. Yeah? So what we're going to be doing is looking at wisdom, then looking at ethics, meditation, and looking at ethics. Yeah? So far, so clear? Let's hope. So then everybody's heard of this term, shunyata. It gets bandied about a lot. It's often translated as emptiness, thus entering emptiness. Emptiness isn't a very good translation for it, especially in the West, because we tend to think of emptiness as absence, as lack. We tend to think of an empty box. It's interesting, people have also been quite attracted by the title, but actually the translation of emptiness is actually, for us, I think, especially not very good. It suggests that the goal of spiritual life, this X that Buddhism's saying is there all the time, is a kind of emptiness, is a kind of blank, is a kind of void. It's even translated as void, isn't it? One Buddhist scholar suggests it should be translated as the... I can't remember now. It's just gone straight out of my mind. It'll come back to me in a minute. Bhante translates what likes to translate it as mystery, which I really much, much prefer. Mystery, for me, has an attractive, something to explore, something I can't really talk about, but something I can explore, something that's wonderful. So you could translate it as mystery. I keep on expecting this other word to come up, but never mind, I'll come back. So it's really important, right from the outset of this course, to remember that throughout its history, Buddhism has always been saying there is something more. There is something quite outside of your normal experience. There is something quite different to your normal sensing experience. So there is some, as it were, other reality. And you'll hear us saying as it were quite a lot, because we're not trying to talk literally. The Buddha's saying no, it's not, the Enlightenment's not a place where people go. It's not a literal other reality like some sort of fairyland that you arrive at. But then you say, so it's just me. And the Buddha said, no, it's not you. It's not a nice little place that you have in yourself somewhere. It's not something you can have yourself. It's other than you, but it's not absolutely separate from you. And so we go on. So we'll go on for the whole 6 weeks trying to work out what we're talking about. But if you just start with thinking, Buddhism's saying there's something much, much more. I think that this later tradition of these bodhisattva figures, Vajrasattva, Rajagosha, all these wonderfully beautiful figures, are, I think, the closest that Buddhism gets to giving you a flavour of that more. So if you look at that figure, if you look at figures, bodhisattva figures, they're supposed to be, they're usually 16-year-old princes or princesses, they can be male or female. They're exquisitely beautiful. They scintillate with beauty. They're nearly always coloured, so they'll be green or red or white, even black. And that colour is radiant, supposed to be like sunlight through silk. So the colour of Vajrasattva is supposed to be this dazzling white, supposed to be the colour of sunlight on snow. Whereas, for instance, Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, is supposed to be the colour of a conch shell, sort of softer white. Yeah? So Vajrasattva is this brilliant white figure. He holds a bell, and he holds... He holds a vajra. And he holds it in this beautiful kind of dancing mudra. He has this beautiful crown of jewels. He's dressed in silks. He's seated on a white lotus. So, if you were at a junior school and you were to say, is that a positive figure or a negative figure? Is this one to be frightened of or attracted to? It'd be very, very easy to say what kind of figure it is. It's a positive figure. It's intensely attractive. And Buddhism is saying, this more is like that. If I was to, because I can't explain it, I could only create a picture of it. And of course you'll be most attracted to people, because human beings are wired for human beings. You'll be most deeply moved by the reality of people. So here's this person that communicates it. Here they are, this incredible scintillating figure surrounded by rainbow light, sitting in this blue, deep blue sky. And Buddhism says, that's it. That's how things really are. Yeah. So the reason I wanted to stress that right from the beginning is one of the problems we're going to be facing throughout the course is negation, because of this idea of shunyata, emptiness, void, that something is going to be lost. Actually, something is lost, and what is lost is you. You are lost. Yourself, your ego is lost. So it is, in another way, terrifying. Bhante in a seminar says that the wrathful forms, you see some wrathful forms of Buddhas surrounded by flames, they look terrifying, some of them have a goat's head or a bull's head, stamping on figures. And Bhante says that those figures are nowhere near as frightening as the peaceful deities. That it's this figure that would actually be terrifying. And it's terrifying because to behold this figure, you have to die. Your egotism, your sense of me, 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 has to be completely shattered and obliterated. So from that point of view, the figure is terrifying. And yet, if you were to let that terror just sort of pour through you, you would suddenly see the figure just as it is, beautifully peaceful, beautifully radiant, incredibly enticing. So it's really important to remember that, I think, that this more, this shunyata that we keep talking about, this emptiness that Buddhism talks about, this mystery, is this figure. This figure is an expression of that. It's as close as you can get to that before all images and words disappear. Any questions about that before we go on a bit more? Anyway, it's difficult to ask questions about that. But. And it's best to think of this figure as existing. As being a figure that you can call to, talk to, approach. I think that's a much healthier idea than thinking it's merely a picture, or that it's merely a kind of psychological tool. Because as soon as you do that, you reduce it to instrumentalism. You see that you make it into doing something for you, and the whole point is to outstrip you. So the Buddhist tradition, generally speaking, has really valued worship and puja and this sense of connection with this kind of divine figure. I personally feel more and more that we need that in the West, very, very deeply indeed. We're frightened of it because we think, hang on, we're back to God again. I thought we got away from him. Buddhism doesn't believe in God. Vajrasattva is not God. It's much, much more frightening. makes God pale. But we need this sense of connectedness with this kind of divine figure in a way. Now, this figure doesn't literally exist, but then, according to Buddhism, nor do you. We create this polarity because we think, well, I exist, so do those things exist? So when we say, do bodhisattvas exist? Do Buddhas exist? What we mean is, I exist, I have breakfast, I send emails. Do they exist? But actually, it's based on the false assumption that we exist in the way we think we do. One of the main things we'll be exploring in this course is that we don't exist in the way that we think we do. It's not that we don't exist, we're not a picture of our own imaginations, but we don't exist, absolutely don't exist, in the way we think we do. And nor does Vajrasattva. He both exists and doesn't exist, just as we exist and don't exist. He both is there and is a mirage, a picture, an imagination, just as we are. Yeah. So really there's no real difference between us, it's just that we think there is. Because we've got this inbred sense that no, it's all very well for you, but I definitely exist. I think that's clear to me. And we're going to try and explore that I-existing feeling. So let me just see if I can take us on from that. Okay.
Shunyata, or is it, are the other figures symbolized quality of these things as well.
Yeah, so Bhante says that what you have in Buddhism, you have a whole array, those of you who know Buddhism a bit, you have a whole array of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. You have, and they all represent different things, or are supposed to. But we should be very, very careful with that. In early Buddhism, what you see is they sort of morph into each other. So Avalokiteshvara suddenly looks like Manjugosha, Tara suddenly changes colour. They all kind of, they're much, much more fluid than they've been passed down to us. So we tend to like to know, okay, this one stands for that, that one stands for that. Bhante's take, he says it's better to think of there being the Bodhisattva. Sometimes that Bodhisattva appears as Manjugosha, sometimes as Avalokiteshvara, sometimes as Mahakala, and so on and so on. There's a value to that idea of them having particular qualities. But it's only a method, yeah? So it's best to think of there being somebody you can have a relationship with, as it were, and not get too worried about whether it's this figure or another. I could just as well be talking about Manjugosha or Tara or Avalokiteshvara. They're just different ways in. According to Tibetan tradition, Vajrasattva represents primordial nature. He's supposed to be the Adi Buddha. He stands behind all the Buddhas. But then in different systems you get other figures doing that. So yeah, it's not as fixed as it looks. And we tend to want to kind of give them all little names and attributes. And that's fair enough, but it's not really quite the spirit. Okay, so what I want to do now, we're going to have a cup of tea in a minute, and I've hardly started what I was going to say. So what I want to do after tea break is start to explore the fact that we don't know reality, the fact that we're not usually in touch with Shunyata, and the consequence that has on us, here and now, in the present. And particularly I want to explore dukkha, which is in a way, or another way of thinking about dukkha, unsatisfactoriness, it's usually translated, is where Buddhism starts. It starts very often with a sense of jarringness, of not workingness, of something being unsatisfactory. And one way of thinking about that is it's unsatisfactory because it's not real. Yeah. But we'll come back to that.